Well, that's a lot that's happened in the last several centuries. A lot that's gone on that we looked back at as we kind of turned into the year 2000. Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech from the steps in Washington, D.C. World War II and the insanity that was the Holocaust. Technological triumphs, like putting a man on the moon for the first time. How do we know any of that stuff is true? How do we know the facts that we've kind of all, through mutual consensus, agreed as history? How do we know that it's fact or really just cleverly wrapped propaganda and fiction? Some of you may be aware that there is a growing, small but growing fringe group of folks that are questioning the existence of the Holocaust. Saying things like, the Holocaust was the greatest hoax perpetuated during the 20th century. And this is not just kind of like fringe lunatics. These are some professors at major universities in this country. Now, I don't think that just 60 years later, there is much of a chance that our generation is going to become convinced that millions of Jews were not tortured and killed by the Nazis during World War II. But I thought about it. It's only 60 years later, and people are coming forward with these kind of theories. Only 60 years later, when eyewitnesses and victims still alive that can walk forward and tell their story. I thought about what happens 100 years from now? What happens 500 years or 2,000 years from now when those eyewitnesses and those victims are long gone? How are our descendants 2,000 years from now going to look back and prove that the Holocaust was indeed fact? We're faced with a similar challenge today. How do we stand here in the year 2000 and look back 2,000 years and determine whether the Bible is fact or fiction? How the Bible was created 2,000 years ago and the facts that are in there, are they true or not? Well, fortunately for us, there's precedence here. There's precedence that's been set within the academic community about how you go back and ascertain the credibility or the reliability of historical reports. And so what we're going to do today is, based on that academic precedent, we're going to take a look at five basic steps that you need to take, whether it's our descendants 2,000 years from now looking back on the Holocaust or us looking back 2,000 years on the Bible, five steps that you take to sort through historical events and literature for fact versus fiction. Here's the first one, probably of no surprise to you. First step is you listen to the witnesses. You get the witnesses together and you listen to their story. Now, for us today, looking at the Holocaust only 60 years ago, this is relatively easy for us to do. My wife used to be a nurse, and I can remember one of the elderly patients she took care of was a gentleman who, when he wore short sleeves, you could see the numbers still branded on his arm that the Nazis had given in a concentration camp. We could bring him up on stage today, and he could tell his story. Or we could bring him into a court of law, and he could tell his story. And then we could parade up one by one other survivors from the Holocaust to tell their stories. And if we started to get a general theme there, if we started to get facts that lined up with each other, we, like any court of law, would lean heavily into the eyewitness testimony. Well, today, when it comes to the Bible, I could stand up here and I could tell you about my quest that I took 12 years ago, where I spent 2 years trying to determine the reliability of the Bible, especially versus other religious documents. I could stand up here and talk to you about how, when I came to that realization, the change that happened in my life, my coworkers at P&G, the folks who worked for me on my brand, could talk to you about how Brian changed from just anything to get ahead to actually asking questions like, is this the right thing? My friends around me could come up here and talk about how my relationships changed, about how my dating relationships changed, how I changed from someone who is exclusively just looking for what could I use this person for, to at least starting to ask the questions of how could I serve this person. And I could stand up here, and I could alone could be the one to tell you about how my heart changed. And how I went from scratching and clawing so hard for so long to become a brand manager at P&G to then saying, no thanks, I think I'm going to walk away because I need to spend all my life full time sharing this truth with other people. You're going to probably sit there and you realize there's a little bit of a hole in this. There's a little bit of problem with both of those cases. And it's this. As good as care as my wife gave that gentleman, I doubt very seriously if 2,000 years from now he's going to be around or any of anybody else to tell their stories from the Holocaust. And I could stand up here today, and I'm limited because I can only tell you my story, but I wasn't around 2,000 years ago. I wasn't around to witness the creation of the Bible. I didn't walk with Jesus in the Middle East and hear and see what he did. In both of those cases, there's a problem. And that's that we do not now physically have the eyewitnesses here to talk about it. And 2,000 years from now, they won't have the Holocaust survivors around. So what's a seeker of historical truth to do? Well, what you do is you hope that the eyewitnesses at the time utilize the best available technology to record their testimonies. Fortunately, in 2,000 years, they'll be able to do this with the Holocaust. Some of you may be familiar that Steven Spielberg is engaged in a major, major project right now to use the best available technology to document the stories of the remaining Holocaust survivors. And while, granted, it's not CD-ROM or digital audio, we are fortunate because the eyewitnesses from the creation of the Bible and that were around when Jesus walked on this earth utilized the best available technology to record their accounts. Either they did it personally or they did it through a historian. On something most often was papyrus, which was an early precursor to paper. So we have their accounts. But hey, I mean, that was 2,000 years ago. You may be saying the same things that I said. How can we believe that what we've got now, what we read, people pass on to us as the Bible, is really what those eyewitnesses wrote 2,000 years ago? I mean, come on. It's been hand-copied over and over again. It's been handed down throughout different political regimes, different religious structures. Come on. Don't you think there was a little creative shaping of this? Don't you think there was a little propaganda inserted to support people's opinions? Don't you think it's probably been tampered with? I mean, 2,000 years is a long time. What's a seeker of historical truth to do? Well, what we do is we have to continue to step two. It's not just enough to listen to the witnesses when they're not in your presence. Second thing we need to do is we need to verify the records. We need to verify whether what we have, whether it's a piece of film or it's a piece of paper, we need to verify that what we have is the credible testimony of those witnesses, that it hasn't been toyed with. Fortunately for us, there is established protocol in this area. The Bible is not the only ancient manuscript that has been tested for liability, that people have need to lay out a protocol for looking at in order to determine what history was. There's a lot of other documents that needed to be done. Military historian C. Saunders has probably kind of written the book on this. He proposed and developed something that was now become known as the bibliographical test. The bibliographical test predominantly takes ancient manuscripts and asks two questions of it. For reliability, to answer the question, is this really the testimony that these people wrote down that long ago? Because whether it's Plato or Aristotle or whatever, none of the documents we have are the exact piece of paper that Plato wrote on. In no document of antiquity, ever, anywhere in the world, from ancient times, do we have the exact document. What we have are handwritten copies that scribes and students of these people then copied down at later dates. So the first question of the bibliographical test is, how many of those ancient documents, how many of those ancient copies do we have on hand? Because the more we have on hand, the more we can compare and contrast one versus other on the exact same things and see, is there any difference here? Has this one been changed versus this? And we can see, is there a harmony? Is there an agreement or not? And that's the first step of the bibliographical test that's been developed. We've seen this chart before, but I'd like to kind of review it here. This is the first answer to that test as we take a look at documents of antiquity. We take a look at the leading documents of antiquity from Greek and Latin times. Take a look at Caesar and the account of the Gallic Wars. There are 10 existing manuscripts that historians are able to compare and contrast for validity and credibility of that account of the Gallic Wars. Plato, there's 7 existing manuscripts in libraries around the world that historians are able to compare and contrast to test their credibility. Aristotle does better. 49 existing ancient manuscripts of Aristotle that are being able to be compared. And the best of this group is the Iliad, which a lot of us may have read in school. Homer's account in the Iliad, 643 existing manuscripts from antiquity of the Iliad. And this is as good as it gets for ancient documents. There are none that exceed these. Except for one, the New Testament documents that were written 2,000 years ago. Take a look at that. 24,633 ancient copies of the New Testament that historians are able to compare and contrast to be able to answer that question, has this been changed or not? Now, I have to admit, there's a big piece of me that wishes that it wasn't 24,633 versus 643. I mean, I remember when we were at P&G and a vice president would ask us a question in a big meeting that we wouldn't know the answer to. I mean, what do? You pick a reasonable number and you round up by 10%, and then you say it with great confidence. We wonder why their stock is maybe in a bad place right now. But the fact is, there is no close second here to the New Testament. There is no close second in this first variable from the bibliographical test of the number of ancient manuscripts that exist. But there's a second question, there's a second variable in the bibliographical test. If we're going to really determine how credible is these documents, and that's this. Because none of these, the original, exists, the question is, what is the oldest manuscript we possibly have? And what is the time gap between when we know that one was written and when the original was first written? What is the time gap between our oldest existing copy and the original? And we take a look at these leading documents again. Caesar's account within the Gallic Wars. The elapsed time between when the original was written in between 144 B.C., and the earliest existing copy from 900 AD is 1,000 years. Plato, it's similar. It's 1,200 years. Excuse me. Aristotle again, it's pretty good. 1,400-year gap between the two. And Homer's The Iliad, again, comes out as the cream of the crop in documents of antiquity here. Original was written about 900 BC. The earliest existing copy we have is 400 BC. Only about a 500-year gap for Homer. But again, Homer's number two. Number two by a long shot. Let's take a look at the New Testament. The gap between when the New Testament was first written and the earliest existing manuscript we have on hand is between 25 and 85 years. Between 25 and 85 years. And folks, this isn't theory. These documents of the New Testament, these are available. These are available around the world in places like the British Museum. And places like the Beatty Museum in Dublin, and places like the Institute of Paris. These things are available. 25 to 85 years. On both of the variables of the bibliographical test, there is no close second to the New Testament of the Bible. Folks, this is not some kind of clever test that some Bible thumper thought up to be able to prove the Bible. This is the established academic test that you lay on any documents of antiquity. Folks, we have to be consistent. We have to be consistent. When was the last time you were in school and people were questioning whether Aristotle lived? Whether the Gallic Wars even happened or not? Those questions don't happen. But I tell you, I sat through 4 years of college where people talked about the theory of this myth of Jesus. Folks, you do not have a leg to stand on from the academic record on those kind of irresponsible comments. Maybe that's why the leading authority in the world on ancient manuscript credibility felt it necessary to issue a statement about this. Sir Frederick Kenyon, who's a director and principal librarian of the British Museum, said that the interval then between the dates of original composition and the earliest evidence becomes so small, he's talking about the Bible, as to be in fact negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. I mean, that may be why, of 184,590 words in the New Testament, do you know how many are on scholars' lists of questionable? They're not quite sure of the context. They don't quite agree on the meaning of that word. It's 400. That's less than a fraction of 1% of the words in the New Testament are even on scholars' list of questionable, where they're quite not sure, they're not in agreement on the context, they're not in agreement on the meaning. And a fraction of less than 1%. That, folks, that's better than Brian Tome in any given 5 minutes up here. And leading scholars have said, hey, those 400 words that are on the questionable list, even though that it's less than a fraction of 1%, we can tell you that in none of those words do any of the possible variations of those words have any effect whatsoever on the Christian faith. But then one of the things, little sound bites that I hear often, even people that have kind of been exposed to this, well, yeah, but isn't that, the Bible's full of contradictions. A bunch of errors in the Bible, a bunch of mistakes in the Bible. The first question I often ask is, okay, go ahead, tell me them. At least nine out of 10 times, people have no idea what they're talking about. All they've heard is some pop culture soundbite that there's errors in the Bible. 1 out of 10 times, though, people do have some real things that they bring forward. And I will admit, there are passages in the Bible that are difficult to understand. There are cross-references in the Bible that if you don't look at them closely, can be a little confusing. Now, I wish I had time the rest of the service to go through like the top 10 of ones I've heard, although there's probably only about maybe 5 or 6 that I really hear very much. But let me just grab the one that I hear the most. Do a little example here. And what it is, it's a sample from 2 different places in the Bible where there is an account of what happened at the empty tomb of Jesus after the resurrection. First one's in Matthew, book of Matthew 28:5. And the line says, "The angel said to the women, 'Do not be afraid.'" And then what we see is the exact same scene recorded in the book of John later in the Bible. And here's the way John describes the scene. John 20:10-13. Says, "Then the disciples went back to their homes, but Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw 2 angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, 'Woman, why are you crying?'" Aha! I've heard, aha, look, the angel said to the women, women, plural, look at John. The angel asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" Here John's saying that Mary was there by herself at the tomb, and here Matthew is saying that there was a group of women. See what I mean about the Bible? But folks, and I'm telling you, this is the one that I hear the most. Anybody here that has ever read a story in Newsweek and a story in Time about the exact same event would know that 2 different reporters can report different details and different specifics of a situation without one of them being telling the truth and one of them lying. All that's happening here is Matthew is talking about what the angel said to the women, and John is talking about a specific question that was asked of Mary. So the angel came up and said to the women, "Do not be afraid." And then looked at Mary and said, "Woman, why are you crying?" There's no discrepancy there, folks. There's 2 different reporters, including different details, that do not contradict each other. I mean, if it's things like this, why do we think that people carry around kind of the soundbite of there's all these errors or all these contradictions in the Bible? Well, I'm not saying it's true for everyone, but I have a theory with most people of why it is. It's a little clip I want to take a look at. I think this is the exact reason why so many people carry this soundbite around. In a large number of the cases, the people I'm interacting with have spent significantly more time reading some pop culture opinion of the Bible than ever having read it for themselves. Okay, well, but back to the case at hand. I mean, this document integrity of the Bible is a big, big deal. It's not even the place where the academic discussions about the Bible are being fought on anymore, because it's such an open and shut case now. But you know what? All that answers is the question of, is what we have in hand what these eyewitnesses wrote down? What it doesn't answer is, were these eyewitnesses, were these historians in the Bible a bunch of nutcases in the first place? Doesn't answer that. So a seeker of historical truth can't stop at step number 2. We got to go to step number 3. We've got to ask ourselves a question: is there outside verification for any of this? Now, I want to admit here, before I do this, that there's some fuzzy logic going on here. I mean, this definition that the only credible observers of what happened were people who are not Christians. That the only credible outside verification for the Bible are people that didn't believe the claims of Christ in the first place. I mean, what we're basically saying is that if there's a historian, regardless of their reliability, the minute they started believing what Jesus was saying, they are no longer a credible source of what he said. So that the only people that are a credible source of what Jesus said are the people who disagreed with it. I mean, that would be like us saying the only credible source of what happened in the Holocaust will come from Nazi sympathizers. The only credible source of what happened in the Holocaust will come from those who deny that it ever happened. But it's a reasonable question we need to ask. Let's find some outside observers. And you know what? I think this is another soundbite. Most people, if you ask them, would say there is no outside verification of things that happened in the Bible. You know, most people would be very much wrong. I want to run through these quickly, and there's a ton more that we could do. But this is just not a true statement. I mean, there's people like Thallus, who was a Roman historian in 50 AD. And remember, all these people I'm going to mention are not only not Christians, but most of them were often strong opponents of Christ and strong opponents of Christianity. Thallus, a Roman historian from 50 AD. Josephus, a Jewish historian from 80 AD, who in his work, although he did not believe in Jesus, in his work, he describes Jesus as a wonder worker and describes his crucifixion. Tacitus, who was a Roman historian. Tacitus described Jesus and some of the things that he did. And he described what Emperor Nero did and the fact that he persecuted Christians after Jesus was gone. And no matter what Tacitus described as exquisite tortures that he applied to Christians, he could never get them to recount what they had seen. The Babylonian Talmud, not by any means Christian document whatsoever, describes this character named Jesus of Nazareth and says that he performed magic and that he was executed on Passover Eve and that after he was gone, they list five of his disciples specifically and that they healed the sick in his name. Again, this is the outside verification, and we could go on and on. There is a litany of independent historians. But I want to linger here, because there's a tougher question we need to be asking. It's a tougher question our friends 2,000 years from now will need to be asking about the whole. Excavate and try to find the ruins of some of the concentration camps. They will need to search for and see if there's any remnants left that they can look at the Nazi war machine. Now for us today, I mean, we're reaching all the way back to early AD and then even into BC for the Old Testament of the Bible. We've got even a stronger challenge here. But it's a question that we need to ask. Is there any physical evidence we can bring into this court? Well, fortunately for us, there is a whole group of kind of Indiana Jones types in a very respectable profession called archaeology that do this for a living. So we don't quite have to get dirt under our fingernails to look for this stuff. Well, let me warn you, it's a very strong record here. Here's what one of the leading archaeologists, Miller Burroughs from Yale, has to say about the archaeological record. He says, on the whole, archaeological work has unquestionably strengthened confidence in the reliability of scriptural record. Folks, this is not Billy Graham talking here. I mean, wow, it has unquestionably strengthened confidence in the reliability of the scriptural record. And what is he talking about? Well, here we go. Here's just a few examples of some of the kind of things that Miller Burroughs is referring to. For a long time in academic circles, there was a mockery made of people that believed in the credibility of the Bible as a historical document. And the main thing that was shoved in their face was a civilization called the Hittites. If there was any kind of debate going on within academic circles and somebody was proposing that the Bible was actually credible, the other person would just kind of shut down the conversation by going, oh yeah, well, what about the Hittites? Face. Didn't happen after 1906, though. In 1906, some workers at an excavation uncovered significant evidence and references to the Hittite civilization. And now here we are, like 100 years later, and since that time, they have uncovered hundreds and hundreds of references and examples of the Hittites. Hundreds of references. They've discovered over 40 cities that compose the Hittite civilization. They've discovered that the Hittite civilization spanned at least 1,200 years of time. And from the scholars, at least the critics, the response was a collective, never mind. Here's the deal. The Old Testament, though. I mean, you could talk about the bibliographical test for the New Testament, but the Old Testament, there is such a gap in the time between the various documents that we have. There is no way those ancient scribes, when they copied these down, that there wasn't a little kind of persuasion going on. That over the time, the gaps are so huge that these documents weren't altered. And for a long time, scholars who believed in the historical reliability of the Bible, their kind of wildest dream was, man, what if we could uncover some documents from maybe hundreds and hundreds of years before the most recent one that we have that we might be able to compare and contrast? Was there changes going on over time? And then in 1947, it happened. A Bedouin shepherd who was tracking a lost sheep into a cave in an area called Qumran, about 10 miles east of Jerusalem, discovered some clay pots. And inside those clay pots is what's come to be known as the Dead Sea Scrolls. You may have heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but you may not understand what the big deal was about them. The big deal about the Dead Sea Scrolls was here in one fell swoop, they discovered ancient manuscripts of the Old Testament that was 1,000 years older than the previous copies they had had. 1,000 years on the exact same books of the Bible. And scholars were able to sit down and compare the two. And they found that in this 1,000-year gap between these two copies they had, the documents were exactly the same, word for word, in over 95% of the words. And the remaining 5% were variations of spelling of the same word and some slips of pen that they had seen. 1,000 years and it hadn't changed. And the collective response from critics? Oh, never mind. Ah, but wait. Here's the deal. Here's why I can't believe in the reliability of the Bible. See, in the New Testament, around Jesus, there's all these figures described. They're supposedly these major religious and political figures, and there is no record of them, no record whatsoever outside of the Bible. There's never been any archaeological discoveries to support this, and of all the documents and manuscripts we have outside of the Bible, there is none that exists that lists these people. There is no way there were people as politically powerful as listed that were part of Jesus' life. There's no way they existed if the only account of them we have is in the Bible. We would find references to them outside of the Bible in these other works. Perfect example of the mythology in the Bible, particularly around Jesus. Perfect example. Folks like Caiaphas, who is described as the high priest who presided over Jesus' trial. If he was that powerful of a religious and a political person, there would have to be at least one record outside of the Bible. The Bible has kind of composed some figures, and there's kind of this myth that's grown around them. Well, you don't hear Caiaphas brought up anymore. Because in 1990, some construction workers building a water park in Jerusalem inadvertently broke through the ceiling of a hidden burial chamber from the first century AD. I guess call before you dig takes on particular relevance for Middle Eastern homeowners. You know what they found? They found an ornate ancient burial box that was inscribed that it was the remains of Caiaphas, the high priest. That was 1990. And the collective response from the critics, never mind. But wait. There's this one thing that I just cannot get past. I mean, there's these major figures in the Old Testament of the Bible. King David, probably he and Moses are probably the two most predominant characters in the Old Testament. Here's all these accounts of King David and how glorious his reign was. And there is no record of King David in any of our historians' accounts outside of what we have within the Bible. No record of King David on any manuscripts. And you know what? No record of King David in any of the digs that we've done. And by now, my goodness, it's the 90s. By now, technology has advanced so far. We've done radar scans of the ground. We've done all kinds of digs throughout the Middle East. Not one single record that there was a person named King David. Obviously, an Old Testament myth for the convenience of the Bible. And then on July 21st, 1993, at the Tel Dan excavation, workers came across a shattered monument. And in that monument, it listed the King of Israel and the House of David. Here's how U.S. News recorded this discovery. U.S. News and World Report. The reference to David was a historical bombshell. Never before had the familiar name of Judah's ancient warrior king, a central figure in the Hebrew Bible, and according to Christian scripture, an ancestor of Jesus, been found in the records of antiquity outside of the pages of the Bible. Skeptics had long seized upon that fact to argue that David was a mere legend. And I'll tell you, it hasn't changed. Collective response of skeptics has been a very convenient, never mind. And folks, this is just a sample. I literally could spend the rest of the time here today bringing up archaeological find after archaeological find. Maybe that's why we've seen major magazine covers in the 90s that have said things like this. Is the Bible true? New discoveries offer surprising support for key moments in Scripture. Another one that we've seen, the U.S. News also did. Archaeology's amazing finds in the Holy Land. You know, I want to be careful here because archaeology is never going to prove the Bible. We are never going to prove 100% the Bible. But I can tell you, with all the technological advances that have been made, with all the work and all the scrutiny that's gone on, I would agree with the guy from Yale. Archaeology has done nothing but strengthen my belief in the reliability of the Bible. There has been no discovery ever in archaeology that has made me feel any other way. Folks, this stuff starts to add up. Let's not have let our kind of moral decisions influence what is truth or not. You start to look at the historical record. You start to look at what happens when we dig into the ground. It starts to add up. I start to question whether somebody can honestly have reasonable doubt on the historical reliability of the Bible. 100% proof? No. Reasonable doubt? I think it's been destroyed. Now the danger here is that we could go into kind of serious egghead overdrive. You know, and we could just keep kind of looking at facts and keep looking at statistics here. But if you're an honest seeker of the truth, you can't end, as strong as that stuff is, you cannot end in step 4. We've got to go to the 5th step, which is that you need to use your other senses as well. You need to compare this to your experience. And I can tell you, after I spent all that time in those 4 steps over about a 2-year period in my life, and I came to believe that it was intellectual suicide for me to say that the Bible was not credible and true, I could stand up here and tell you about my experience and my life change. And you know what? We could draw other people out of this audience. We could pray them up one by one and spend the rest of the day talking about people who've had amazingly similar stories. We could draw people from all over the world, from all throughout history, who've had amazingly similar stories. See, because the fact is, it's not only true in those first 4 points, the fact is that lives and breathes in the 5th is that it works. And that's what that makes me so mad about the kind of irresponsible, pseudo-intellectual sound bites that are thrown out that just aren't true. Because they're stopping people from embracing something that works. Something that changes marriages. Something that improves lives. Something that takes us out of this miserable existence and scramble for significance. So as we start to add all this up, I mean, you probably have the predominant question I have in my mind is, well, then why don't more people believe? Well, I think there's different reasons. You can't paint everybody with the same brush here. I think that one of the reasons why people don't believe is that there's some of us in here are just honest seekers. We're just on a path of gathering the information, and this is one part of it today. And this is exactly why Crossroads was created. This is exactly why I walked away from my career for the privilege of standing up here. And I want to encourage you to stay on that path. And we have a class that we regularly do here called Quest for God, which wrestles a lot more significance into these questions and others. And it's for people who are asking these questions. I want to encourage you, it's going to be offered again in the fall, to join us for that. And it's always full up by the time that we announce the class. So I want to tell you today, if you want to do that, if you will write the word quest on the top of your Connect card, I will make sure you get on a priority list to be able to make it into that class this fall. It's led by Chuck Proudfit, who had all these questions when he first came from Crossroads. He started on this intellectual journey questioning all the world religions while he was at Harvard, and it culminated here, and he leads the class now. There's another group in here, though, and I think it's like that guy in the video. They just haven't read the Bible. They've spent more time hearing these kind of pop culture sound bites about the Bible than they've ever looked for themselves. And if that's where you are, I just want to encourage you to do a radical thing, and that is read it. That's why we make free, available, New Testaments of the Bible out at the Information Center every weekend. Grab one. And then start in the book of John and read through that. You know, there's a third group. I would not be honest with you if I didn't tell you that there's a third group in here who don't believe. And this third group, I can't find any kind of mellow way of saying this. They're just scared. They're scared that if all that stuff is true, what does that mean for their life? I think that's what happens with what people are calling the Holocaust deniers. I think the Holocaust reveals a fundamentally profound dark side of humanity. I think there is some ugly truth about what mankind is capable of that some people, because of their moral choices or whatever, have a vested interest in not believing that that's true. Some people, because of their political persuasion, have a vested interest in saying the Holocaust must not have happened. And I think it's the same for the Bible. I think there's a lot of us that have a vested interest. We're scared of the moral decisions we're going to have to make. Because what the Bible is a mirror. And it shows us some ugly truth about ourselves that we don't want to wrestle with. I'm not proud to say that was me. I went through kind of all the intellectual searching over a 2-year period. And I came to the place where I said, factually, I can't push back on this anymore. Uncle, this, intellectually, it is not credible for me to say the Bible is not reliable truth. But I still didn't believe. I spent, it was probably at least another year. Because I had a vested interest in the way I was living my life at the time that I didn't want to make changes. I was scared of the moral choices that were going to be ahead of me. Until after about a year of that, I finally developed the courage to just start walking toward it. To say, I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to be perfect. I'm not going to figure it out and be able to make all these choices right away. But I'm going to start walking toward this God that I've proven to be true. And the amazing thing was, as I looked in the Bible, I realized that that's exactly where this God meets us. He meets us in our brokenness. He doesn't require us to get all prettied up and cleaned up. God meets us there. And we cannot let those kind of moral indecision stop us from making a decision that has eternal significance. You know, out of all my search and everything that I've done, and I can get into data overload on this kind of stuff, there was one fact, one predominant fact that rose above all the rest about the Bible. And it was this. I came to agree with one of the leading theologians of the 20th century. The most important factual piece about the Bible is that Jesus loves me. This I know. For the Bible tells me so. So if I verified all that stuff, if all these facts are true, and then I look in the Bible and it tells me that God loves me, wow, that must be true too. And what does that mean for my life? And what is the significance of that to me? Next week, we're going to be taking a look at the scandalous record of the life of this guy called Jesus. In answering that question, what does it mean to us? You don't want to miss it. Let's pray. God, I ask for internal honesty for all of us, and I ask for courage. In Jesus' name.